Hi, everybody. Welcome to the first Wireside Chat of 2024. Happy New Year. Very excited to be here. I'm Paul Whitcover, the Associate Dean of the Online MFA. I'm joined by Melissa Hart, who's my co-host, also an instructor at the Online MFA and an incredible writer, and our guest tonight, who's Heather Hepler, also an instructor and an incredible writer. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about Heather before we begin. Heather is the author of We Were Beautiful, Frosted Kisses, Love Maybe, The Cupcake Queen, Jars of Glass, Dream Factory, and Scrambled Eggs at Midnight. What a great title. Heather has been making up stories in her head for as long as she can remember. It was an amazing day when she realized that she could use her talent for good instead of evil. Now, instead of making up outrageous stories to explain why her hands were dyed purple, what happened to the last cookie, or why she decided that spending $20 on a talking fish was a good idea, that actually does sound like a good idea, she pours her creative energy into novels. Heather fills her award-winning novels with whatever captures her attention: outer space, cupcakes, Renaissance fairs, bacon truffles, Disney princesses, sea glass, and love potions have all made the list. Currently, she is fascinated with how apples grow and scuba diving. Her writing has received many awards and accolades, and she has been told more than once that when she writes, she makes weird faces. More about Heather can be found by visiting her website, heatherhepler.com, which I think Melissa is going to throw into the chat. There we go. So, Heather, I'm fascinated by the weird faces. Of course, you knew I was going to start there, because how could I not? So how does this come about? Are you like kind of acting out the characters that you're writing about as you write about them?
Yes, that's exactly right. I think for me, especially when I'm writing scenes, I find myself making the faces and even doing some of the gestures, and that helps me to write. The best place for me to write is in public spaces where there's a lot of people and a lot of noise. And so I'm often observed doing this. Several of my novels I actually wrote in kind of the, there's like a little lounge area associated with the gym where I would teach yoga. And so the 2 hours between dropping my son off at school and teaching yoga, I would go there and sit and write. And students would constantly be streaming past. And I would often get people saying, like, what were you doing today? I just saw you making all these weird faces and gestures. And I wasn't aware of doing it, but I haven't stopped. So I figure that's the best place.
So how are you able to, in an environment like that, how are you able to kind of tune out all of the distraction and noise?
I'm not sure. I think it helps me to just have the busyness around me. When it's too quiet, I find myself getting antsy. But when there's a lot of things going on around me, it actually helps me to create that little bubble where I can work. I've tried to do it. People talk about like, oh, I have music, I just shut the door to my office, and that never works for me. I find myself getting fidgety, and then suddenly I'm doing laundry or scooping the cat box or like whatever else I can find to do besides writing.
Right.
I think the other thing is being away from the house helps me a lot, because then I'm not distracted by all the other things that I think I need to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, do you like write at home, or do you have a outside space?
I'm just sitting here nodding because all of what you just said resonates. People are always surprised that people like us can write in busy, loud coffee houses. But you're right. Something about the stimulus feeds that curious part of my brain and frees the rest of me up to concentrate. And so I'm a big fan of writing wherever I can find that is not adjacent to the dishes and the cat boxes.
Right. Right. Well, that's the benefit of not working at home, right? Because you're unless you're going to bus tables at Starbucks, you're not going to be tempted to wash the dishes or do the laundry. So one of the things that I wanted to, and actually this is a great pairing because Melissa, you have also written in both of these genres. Yeah. But one of the things that I wanted to talk about a little bit tonight, and we'll talk about a lot more other stuff, and again, I hope people will post questions in the chat. I wanted to talk a little bit about middle grade fiction and YA fiction and the difference between them, the overlap between them. Because I know that it's very often something that students in the MFA are confused about. You know, we've had students before who get to the thesis and they start writing and, you know, they present their idea and it turns out to be, it's really a middle grade novel, which is not something that we cover. And it's terrible to have to say to somebody, you can't really write this novel unless you, for the thesis, unless you, you know, make some significant changes to resituate it in terms of genre. So can you just talk a little bit about, like, what are the differences? How important are they and why do they exist?
Well, I'll probably say a lot of things that everybody already knows. So generally, that age group between, I'd say 9 is the low end, and then the high end is supposed to be 18. But I mean, obviously YA has broken out into that upper range all the way up to, I don't know, 70. Those readers always read up. So if your character is like 12 or 13, you're probably going to be getting 9, 10, 11 year olds reading those books. And that's what's happened for me with my middle grade books. I'm getting readers as young as third grade reading my 13-year-old character because they want to know what's next in their lives. They're excited about, you know, oh, what's middle school going to bring? You know, what's my first crush going to be like? What's bullying like in middle school? So I think you're always kind of reading ahead a little bit. So that continues all the way up. So if you're going to be writing a character who's 16, you can't expect high school seniors to be that interested in that character unless you have an extraordinary book like The Hunger Games or something like right. that. You might be able to kind of edge that in with some of the genres. I think for me, it was a surprise when I went from my first 3 novels were solidly YA. So the characters were 16, 17, 18 years old. And then when I moved into my 4th novel, I was surprised that they moved it down to middle grade because initially she was 14. And I thought, okay, that's still young YA, but because of the subject matter of the book, they said, no, we're going to go ahead and position this as middle grade, which I'm super glad they did. And I can talk more about the advantages of that later. But I think that's really the gauge there is like, what's your main character? How old are they? Where are they in their lives? And then you can kind of see it with the readers. And that's usually where publishers position it in my experience.
I'm going to ask you another follow-up question about that. But first of all, what something that you just said was something that I had never realized or thought about. It really lit a light bulb for me, which is that readers read up. I mean, obviously, that stops being the case at a certain time, because if that were true, I'd be reading about 80-year-olds all the time right now. But what it did was illuminate for me the logic behind the kind of new genre or newish genre of new adult. That's where readers who are too old for a 17 or 18 year old protagonist of a YA novel, that's what they're going to be reading because they've aged out in a way in terms of like reading up. Right. Unless they want to read, you know, I don't even know what you want to call it, an adult novel. But those books, those novels may not have the same they may be too far from YA, I guess, which is sort of what they're used to and what they in some respects still want to see. Does that make sense?
Yes. I'm sorry. Was there a question in there?
No, there wasn't. It was just a statement.
Well, but there is a good question in the chat.
Okay. What is it?
Are there any common themes in YA fiction that wouldn't be found in middle grade?
Well, and that gets back to the question I was going to ask, which is you mentioned that your publisher had decided to position your novel as middle grade, even though you had written it as YA. So what, and that was because of something to do with the subject matter. So can you expand on that a little bit and then fold Melissa's question into it?
Sure. I think that the subject matter is pretty much open across the board. It's how it's treated. So if you're going to have abuse in a family and you're going to have it as a middle grade book, you're probably not going to get into a lot of detail. It's definitely going to be age appropriate. And then if it's in YA, it's going to start being a little more obvious. You can start presenting things like We Were Beautiful was my last novel. So I presented drunk driving. I presented a rape scene, but it wasn't very graphic because this was still kind of lower YA. I think you can have a little more latitude there. But if you want it to really be trending down towards middle grade, I think you have to be very careful about some of that, particularly with some publishers. So with Cupcake Queen, I was picked up, my publisher was Penguin, and they did the first run, and then Scholastic picked it up. And so this is something that people who want to write middle grade have to really think about. So Scholastic picked it up, and they have their own rules about content. And I had used the word crap in the original publication, and they were like, either you take this out or we're not going to pick it up.
Wow.
And I talked to my editor about it, and she was like, well, I mean, it's totally up to you. It's your book. But just know that they're buying 500,000 copies. And I was like, oh, okay.
We can you were totally like, oh, crap.
No, it's not a problem. But, you know, like if you do get it picked up by Scholastic and gets put in the book fair, like they have very stringent rules about what is appropriate and what's not. I think there's it's a little looser when you go just with another publisher. Mm-hmm. But they may ask you to change some things too, depending on where they're going to position it in the market. And I know that I've gotten some pushback from other authors saying like, well, why, you know, why would you do that? Why would you allow them to censor you? And I think there's that, like I said, there's that push and pull. Is this really important to me? Can my book actually reach a larger audience if I'm willing to give up the word crap, you know? And so I think that that's just something an author has to decide.
Yeah. I mean, that, there's always a kind of a push and pull with the publisher and with the editor. I mean, the editors, by and large, are going to be your champion in the publishing house, but still, they answer to a higher authority. But it doesn't sound to me like you betrayed your artistic, whatever by removing the word crap from your book.
What did you replace it with?
I just didn't. I rewrote the line entirely.
Okay.
I just got rid of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So here's a question from the chat. Will a 9-year-old heroine hinder the prospect of publication? And I guess this is a question that, you know, really depends on what genre you're going to be publishing or looking to publish your book in, right? I mean, but a 9-year-old protagonist would be squarely middle grade in terms of, audience. If you're writing a middle grade book, it would make sense to have a 9-year-old protagonist if you were going to have a, you know, female protagonist.
Yeah, nine would be tricky, I would say. You know, what? that kind of trends down towards maybe children's chapter books.
I
wouldn't call that middle grade. I mean, it's
low
end of middle grade, maybe.
Okay.
But very low.
It's so interesting how there are these broad categories, which seem to have these very firm demarcation points. But when you look at it more closely, they're not that firm. And it's really like you can take any category like middle grade and break it down even further, right? Like at one extreme, you're verging up into YA, at another. And you're verging down into chapter books. So, I mean, speaking strategically as a writer, should you be avoiding those areas, like where there's some question as to like how the book should be marketed?
I don't think so. I think that generally, I mean, write the book that you're being led to write, like write your own story. And I think that as you do that and you find your editor, they can help you position it. I mean, I'm just thinking of the question with the 9-year-old, and like Ramona Quimby comes to mind. I mean, it's like there's the book Ramona Quimby, age 8. And that is definitely like very low end middle grade. And I would say high end children's chapter book. I mean, if you go into most libraries or bookstores, you're not going to find that anywhere near the YA section, obviously. Mm-hmm. You're probably going to find it more in the children's book. But I mean, those books fly off the shelves. I mean, those are the books that get picked up by Scholastic, that get put on all the honor lists for schools and libraries. I mean, those are the kind of books that teachers want, especially when it becomes a series, because you get somebody hooked on one book and suddenly there's 5 or 6 books and they
right.
love that. So I think it's not dangerous to be having a 9-year-old protagonist.
Here's another question from the chat. Does YA sell more easily for publishing houses than adult and middle grade? And then what are your thoughts about the new adult subgenre?
YSL's great, and it has been for the last, I don't know, 15 years or so, ever since John Green and Twilight came out. And that was right about when my first novel was coming out. So I saw a lot of that. And YA, up until that point, including my MFA program, was misunderstood and maligned. I mean, in my MFA program, I got a lot of like, what do you want to write? I was the only person in that program that wanted to write YA. And I only had one mentor who was willing to mentor me in YA. The rest I had to do adult literary. They weren't interested in that at all. And recently I applied for a PhD program and they said to me, well, you're probably wondering why we're interested in you because we don't have children's in YA here. And I said, well, I suppose that is why you're interested in me because you want to maybe have more variety in your program. So I think that YA is great. I think that there's a lot of changes happening right now. I think there a lot of people are getting kind of tired of the dystopian books. I think they're trying to move into other forms of YA. I think new adult is great because there is that upper end of YA that maybe is getting a little bit too much sexual, too much content, too much drugs, that sort of thing. And it's just not what librarians and teachers and maybe even parents want to give to their 13 or 14 year olds. Mm-hmm. because YA is such a big category, I think it's good to push some of those things into a slightly older category that adults can read without feeling like I'm reading a kiddie book, and older teens can read and say, oh, okay, this is what college life is like, or this is what life is going to be like after high school.
That's so interesting. I mean, I really had, I'm embarrassed to admit, kind of a knee-jerk reaction to the, you know, the establishment of the new adult genre. I felt it was kind of a phony genre in the sense that it was kind of a publishing ploy, really, you know, publishers identifying a particular audience and then creating a genre to go out and get it, which it is to a degree. But you're making me understand in a way that I don't think I had before, that it's a legitimate it exists because there are readers who want to read that material, and that's the bottom line, I guess. So thank you for that, actually. I keep kind of coming back to like the differences between middle grade and YA, and you mentioned some of them, which is like, you know, the amount of detail you can use or how strongly you can describe something or accurately, whether you have to gloss over certain details. But I know, like in YA, for example, over, say, the past 10 or 15 years, what 15 years ago you could not touch in YA, you can now absolutely touch in YA and more than touch it, right? You can describe it in detail. Is something similar happening in middle grade as well?
I think there's a real push right now to get slightly older protagonists in middle grade, so like the 13, 14-year-olds, and having more content without it being, I don't know, too lurid, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like being able to discuss things in a way that is age appropriate, but we're not going to gloss over that this is happening. You know, whether it's abuse, whether it's drugs, whatever's going on in these lives, like we're going to talk about it, but we're not going to talk about it in a way that seems inappropriate for that age group. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask a question as well?
Please.
I mean, I have bumped up against book bans for some content. I'm wondering if you have as well, more and more.
I haven't.
Not at all.
No, I think, well, when my publisher first picked up my very first book, she said, we're looking for clean books. she said, that's why we're going to grab your books. And I think that's where mine have pretty firmly found their audience, is that a lot of my books get picked up in schools and they get picked up in libraries. And I think it's because there's not a lot of what they would say is offensive content. And I'm not writing towards that. That's just what I'm interested in.
Yeah, so sure.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, with one of my middle grade novels, the offensive content was the protagonist's father suffering from clinical depression and anxiety and attempting suicide. And some adults found that that topic was too heavy for young people. So,
wow.
Yeah.
I mean, now that you say that, I mean, they're, my latest book is, like I said, there's a rape scene and a drunk driving mm-hmm. scene where and someone dies in the book. And I'm surprised that mm-hmm. nobody said anything about it, but they haven't. Mm-hmm. So I've been okay.
Yeah, that's cool.
I mean, the publishers don't have any trouble with these books. It's busybodies, essentially, yeah. who have a problem. But so, unfortunately, some of them have real power.
Oh, lots. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to ask that question, Paul, about agents?
I was good. Oh, about the agents?
Oh, no, whichever you want.
Okay, I'll ask the agent question. So somebody wants to know about how to query agents, and I'll turn that a little bit around and just ask, like, how did you go about getting your first agent?
Agents. I hate talking about agents. My first agent was an adult agent only, and a friend of mine connected me with him. I sent him my first book, and he initially was like, well, I don't do YA, but he read it and he liked it so much, he decided to actually expand into YA, which was fantastic. And like I said, that was at the time when John Green had just come out with Looking for Alaska, and I think it was New Moon had just come out. Which I'll wrap around to those stories in a second, but he actually sent them to a number of editors and it got in a bidding war because they were really hungry for more YA at that point. And I actually got signed on with the editor who was John Green's editor. And so that was fantastic. She was by far my favorite person in publishing to date. So that's who I got initially as an agent, but then he left that agency. And the agency said, yeah, you can go, but we're going to keep Heather. So I lost my favorite agent. He left. And so I was stuck with this agency who they weren't that interested in YA. So I think they kept me because my most recent book for them had made a lot of money. And they were like, oh, well, we're going to hang on to her. But they weren't really that interested in pushing YA. So I ended up finding a new agent.
Now, why couldn't you? I'm assuming that your first agent left the agency. Did he drop out of the business completely, or did he start his own agency somewhere else?
He started his own agency, but so, as part of the leaving, he said, I will not take any of former clients with me, nor will I employ them, or nor will I have them. So I was effectively cut off from him, which is super weird.
Like, yeah, because I was wondering, like, well, why couldn't you just quit and then sign up with his agency? But that's why.
Yeah. When he signed, he was like, no, I won't have any relationship with her ever again. So, and my second agent, I actually met at a conference, and we met well before I had left with that first agency. And I finally just contacted her and was like, hey, are you interested in looking at my books? And she said, sure. And so we had a conversation and she ended up being my agent. And it wasn't a good match. I don't know what else to say about that. Mm-hmm. But so I'm currently unagented. So
okay. Are you looking? I mean, it doesn't seem like you necessarily need an agent at this point.
I would definitely like to have an agent, honestly. I don't like to handle all the fussy money bits. I like to, as my very first and favorite agent said, he goes, I'm here to be the money person. I want you to keep clean and just stick with your art. And he was great at that. I also don't feel confident in doing that. I mean, there's just so many things that you can miss and so many mistakes you can make in contracts. I wouldn't know what to ask for. I wouldn't know what rights to keep and what to give away. So.
Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense. What about you, Melissa? What's your agenting experience been like?
I've had the same agent for 15 years and I adore her and she does all the money bits, but she does more than that. She brainstorms with me. We talk about trends and how not to write to those trends. And she's just a champion. She literally is the kind of agent I can write to and say, okay, I'm blocked. I'm never going to write another book. And she says, well, yes, you are. Let's get on the phone and talk about what you're passionate about right now. She's magnificent. And I don't have to think about rights or anything like that.
That's great. And I've had my agent for about that long, maybe even longer, actually. I mean, I don't want to spend the whole time talking about agents, but I know it's something that students are interested in. It is an important part of a professional writer's career, professional fiction writer's career. I absolutely believe that every professional writer in traditional publishing should have an agent. And I can see by the nods that Melissa and Heather agree with me. It's an incredible, it's a weird relationship. In some ways it's like a marriage, right? It's a genuine relationship, and yet it's business, right? Yeah. I've seen a lot of agent writer relationships go badly wrong, misunderstandings, investment that shouldn't have been there, maybe forgetting that it's in the end a business relationship. So that's something that, you know, we try to cover in the MFA is the fraught nature of the agent writer relationship, which can be one of the most incredible relationships in a writer's life. Absolutely. If you get an agent that really gets you and understands you and is a champion, there's nothing better, except maybe to be married to that person. If
I know somebody who's married agent.
My agent married one of his clients. And it was a big, I don't want to say it was a scandal, but everyone was like, really? But they're very happily married, and both of their careers are doing very well. So there you go.
So many good questions in the chat. Heather, are you willing to share the name of your first agent?
Peter Steinberg. He runs the Steinberg Agency out of New York. And he used to be with Regal Literary. He's fantastic, but he's very selective. So,
Maybe we'll get him to come for one of the pitch weekends that we do periodically.
Oh, I'll be jealous because we can't be together anymore.
you can come and pitch your new novel anonymously. You'll never know. But I just to mention, and then I promise we'll get off the topic of agents. If you're in the MFA program, twice a year in the fall and in the spring, we do a pitch weekend where we invite literary agents to come in and in a Microsoft Teams environment, just like this one, you can pitch your novel, your thesis novel, to agents. This is something we offer to all students in their final thesis class, and to students who have graduated since the last pitch weekend. So something to keep in mind if you're considering coming to the MFA or applying to the MFA, that's a little perk we offer at the end. Okay, so let's talk about trends. Here's a question in here. Do you try to follow or track publishing trends with writing your books? I mean, I guess there's a little bit of a difference between tracking a trend and understanding what the publishing environment is like at a particular point and following the trends. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think a lot of times once something becomes a trend, you're too late. And because a lot of times trends, you know, are happening right now. And it's like, well, okay, you've written this book and that takes time. And then now you have to sell that book. And it might be 2 or 3 years until you get that book published. And so you probably have missed the trend, unless it's, of course, dystopian literature, something broad like that. Sometimes you can't predict them. Like my book, Cupcake Queen, came out right at the start of like the cupcake craze when everybody was going bananas for that. And I didn't know that was going to happen. It just was great for my book. So I don't think you can predict that always. I do think that there are oddly trends when it comes to election years. And if you talk to a lot of publishers, they'll talk about that. If you have a Republican coming into office, a lot of the books will trend towards being more school friendly, more busybody friendly, cleaner books. Mm-hmm. And if mm-hmm. you have a Democrat coming into office, things are a little looser. So publishers talk about that. I know, 10 years ago or so, they were talking about zombies, and I thought, that's what? And of course it exploded. I mean, Walking Dead, and then all the books that came out, even, I can't remember, it was called like Cold Heart. There was a YA book that I reviewed for some journal, and it was about a girl who was in love with her dead boyfriend. He was a zombie. And I thought, I didn't see how that was going to work, but it apparently kind of did.
Hey, it's a Romeo and Juliet for a new generation.
Yeah. So I think it's difficult to track trends that way. And I think what I tell my students, at least, is like, if you are trying to write a book like somebody else's, you've already caused a problem for yourself, because you should be writing your own book. Because if you write somebody else's book, it's just going to be like a pale version of that book instead of something that you should be writing yourself. It can be in the same genre, it can have that same setting, but it has to be your book.
But doesn't there come a time, I mean, especially as a beginning writer, and you know, some of our students in the MFA are beginning writers, where your impulse to write is driven as much by what you've read as by what you may have experienced and what your ambitions may be. And so you're, whether consciously or not, kind of emulating another writer. So to me, that seems like almost a necessary stage that you have to go through. But as an instructor, if you see that in a student in the MFA program, how would you get them past that point?
I absolutely agree with what you're saying. I think we tend to write like the authors that we like. And I have found that I can't read fiction while I'm writing, because I tend to write what I'm reading, and that's not great. I think that you can start there, but I think when I'm talking to a student, I might say, okay, well, this is interesting. I like the style. I like the setting. I like the characters, but you know, what are things that interest you? I mean, I might talk to them the way, Melissa, you said you talked to your agent, which is like, mm-hmm. what are things kind of bubbling around in your head right now? Like, what are you experiencing in your life? What are you thinking about? What are you being drawn to? And then how can we inject your book with some of those things, so it feels more like your book and not just Cassandra Clare's latest novel or something right. else like that. But saying all that, publishers, I've had editors at different publishing houses come to me and say, we want you to write a YA book that's like John Green if John Green was a woman. And it's like, I don't know what that means, first of all, but they do that. They come and they say, well, this book has done really well. We want you to write this book, but we want you to set it in, you know, I don't know, Texas, or we want you to set it in France. And it's really hard to kind of write somebody else's book at that point. So I think it's important to figure out, like, how can I still put me and my thoughts into this and make it like this other thing that I might like a lot?
Yeah, I mean, you have to find your own way in, right? And yeah. And if you can't, I guess you can't continue, or at least not honestly.
I mean, I had an editor contact. I was telling you before we started that I'm co-writing a book with somebody. He's a Black man who grew up in inner city Houston, so he wanted to write about his experience there. And my former agent found out about this, not Peter, my other one, found out about this, and she contacted him directly and said, I want you to write a book about football in Texas. And he contacted me right back and was like, why does she think I like football? And I was like, well, because you live in Texas. He goes, but I don't like football. And so, I mean, I think there's that kind of idea of like, we want you to write this kind of book, but if it doesn't fit with the person, then you can't write that. So.
Mm-hmm. May I ask a question?
Please do.
About pacing, particularly in young adult fiction. How fast-paced do you feel YA fiction needs to be these days? I had a previous manuscript in a thesis class where everything was kind of taking place in a bedroom or in a kitchen or in a backyard, but there was no action. It was very internal and conversations, lots of conversations, very little action.
Like that, scenes in a play.
Yeah, yeah. So is that something that readers are interested in, or do they need more action, more plot, faster paced literature, in your opinion?
I think they need faster. I mean, at least I'm always driving my students for that. And like, if you want to talk about something, have your characters moving, have them doing something, going somewhere, and then they can have those conversations, but don't have them sitting in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And definitely don't have them like waking up in the morning and talking to somebody while sitting on the edge of the bed. I think those are book killers right there.
Yeah. Thank you. That was succinct and very helpful.
Yeah. And that is, I'm going to circle back to agents again, even though I said I wouldn't. But I mean, if an agent receives a manuscript that opens with a character waking up and then proceeding to have one of those conversations, that's going to be a black mark against that manuscript. And it might be incredibly well written beginning at page 10. It might be breaking new ground beginning at page 10. But the agent is not going to make it to page 10 because they'll just read that opening and go, well, I've you know, this is not. It's not passing a very basic test. So into the reject pile it goes.
I pretty much, if I see in any point in a book, if somebody's waking up or coming out of a dream sequence, I immediately say, there better be a really good reason for you doing this, because that to me is a book killer right there.
Right. And why? Why is that a bad thing?
I think because the first thing in the morning is never your most interesting part of your day. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but basically my first hour of my day is not something anyone wants to participate in. So unless like I said earlier, unless somebody, your next door neighbor, has gotten a cannon and is shooting it off and everybody's waking up because of that, that might be interesting. But usually I think it's something that a lot of writers want to do because it seems like a good beginning point. I mean, you are beginning your day, therefore that's the beginning of the story. But I always say, basically, you should look at your manuscript, the first 10, 20 pages, and ask yourself, can this be scrapped and then folded in later? Like, probably what I've done in this first 10 pages is work myself into the story. Because I don't know about you, but I'm usually telling myself the story first, and that's not very interesting to watch. And so. Yeah. Usually I get my feet under me around page 20, 30. And so then I have to go back and say, okay, this was just me telling myself the story and I don't need any of that.
Yep. You know, one of the little tricks that I've learned from my own writing, and this is just something that applies to me personally, is like when I come to the end of a book and I'm like, I'm writing the very end of the book, I write it, but then I'm like, I know this is not the end. The real end was about five pages or so earlier. I don't know exactly where, but I'm going to backtrack and find the real end of my book. And it's the same at the beginning, because like you say, you're kind of like, it's like doing warm-up exercises before you run a race or something. I mean, you're not really fully in command yet of your material. Perhaps, I guess some writers are, but I feel like those are two optimal areas for cutting, the beginning and the end. Here's a good question. Any advice on coming up with a story with enough substance for a novel instead of a short story?
I think there are basically two categories of writers, and I'm not saying that you have to fall into one or the other. You just have to know who you are. I think there are short story writers and there are novelists. And if you are a natural short story writer, you're going to have that issue that you just talked about. If you're a natural novelist, you're going to find that your short stories are so like dense and insane that you can't write them correctly and that you have to pull them apart. I think that if you want to write a novel and you're generally in the short story category, I would say just throw stuff in. And that sounds very vague, but
that's a technical term.
Throw stuff in and eventually it will start becoming a novel. Because I remember the first time I wrote a book and I thought, I got to the end of chapter three and thought, well, what am I going to do now? And I started doing that. I was like, oh, kind of looking around like, oh, there's a sale at the grocery store. I should have them go to the grocery store and something will fall off the cart, you know, and it's stuff like that. You start looking at the world around you. You can have natural disasters happen. Those are really helpful. You know, there's a flood in your basement and suddenly like, oh, stuff is happening in your story now that you didn't anticipate. So that's what I think, is that you just have stuff, just throw stuff in. Some stuff's not going to work and you throw it away, but other stuff you just want to constantly cause problems for your characters that they need to solve, and they level up, they learn new skills, they have more issues, and then they keep going. I mean, I tell a lot of my students, think about a video game, you know, and think about like playing Mario Brothers. Each time you start a new scene, you have a new skill. You know, maybe you can double jump now, or maybe you can, you know, shoot fireballs or whatever that is. But you have to defeat something to get that new skill. And that's what you need to look at for a novel, is you need to say to yourself, you know, what is something that your character is lacking? How do they need to get it? And what do they have to defeat either internally or externally to get that? And eventually you're going to have them going on a path, like in The Hobbit. I mean, each time he has a conflict, he learns skills, he overcomes some barrier in his personality and in the external world. And then he's available to work towards that next goal, and he has those new skills with him. I'm not sure. That's how I write books, and that's how I tell people to do it. Just keep leveling your characters up.
I mean, you can see how that would lead to a plot before too long, and especially, you know, once you factor in revision, right? Because you're going to then impose some kind of order or you know, harmony on all of these events that you've kind of thrown in there. But do you plot your books out beforehand, or just kind of wing it as you go?
I'm a pantser. I just go for it. Yeah, I just wing it as I go. But but that makes it really hard in revision. I have a lot of work to do.
Right. I think I'm the same way, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I think when you plot, you have a much easier time in revision because you've made sense of things. So my revision looks like, what is the scene doing? Why did I write this? Is it doing what I need it to do? What is this chapter doing? Why did I write this? And then you have to move stuff around, discard a lot of things. It can be very exhausting, but.
Yeah. How do you work, Melissa? Oh, you're muted.
How do I work? Different ways for different genres, because I write a lot of nonfiction as well. And that tends to be more structured. With novels, it's just a free-for-all, except for this historical novel I'm writing that is so multifaceted that it's going to eat me alive. So please check in with me in a year to see if I have.
This is the one that's based on your own ancestors.
Great-grandparents who were ran away separately to join the circus. Yes.
Yeah, fascinating. But I mean, that's you can see the intersection of a novel like that with your nonfiction background.
Totally.
As well. Yeah.
All the research that goes in makes me happy that I have a journalism background. I have to leave in 2 minutes, but Jessica's asked a question twice and I don't quite understand it, but Jessica asks, is there such a thing as having too many content differences, even if it is coherent and needed/wanted for the content of a series?
Yeah, I saw that before. I don't fully understand. Jessica, can you type in, maybe clarify what that question is? Because I think there's a good question in there, but I just can't quite wrap my mind around what you're asking.
While you're typing, I need to tell Heather that your covers are stunning. And y'all, there's Heather's website again, so you can take a look at the book covers. How much input did you have on all those gorgeous book covers?
Some. Most of them, I just got really lucky. I had a great art team and they gave me a couple of options and all of them were good. So a lot of the times I just said, whatever looks good to you. There was one paperback cover of, I think it was Love Maybe, that came out and it was atrocious. And even my publisher was shocked by it. For some reason, they put this feather boa on my character and they only showed her from like the chest down. And my publisher went, she looks like a prostitute, but it had already gone to press. So we just had to leave it. But I was just like, what were they thinking with this one? The hardcover cover was amazing, but the paperback I went with.
It's like such a bad feeling too, because it's the one part, it's such an important part of your book. And yet, generally speaking, it's the part that a writer has least control over, at least input on. Very unfortunate. Okay, so Jessica chimed in and she did clarify, so I think I understand. And Melissa has had to bounce off. Thank you, Melissa, for all of your work. Okay, so what I think Jessica is asking is like, can your novel be overstuffed with elements that are perhaps not congruous with each other? Like she says, myths, legends, vampires, old souls, and historical aspects all in one. What is too much, I guess?
For sure. I mean, I think it's like cooking. If you put too many ingredients in, it just doesn't make sense anymore. To use my cooking metaphor, I think you need to figure out what's your main ingredient and then what are all the other things doing to enhance that. So if you're going to write about vampires, that's fine. And you probably should find a new way in, because I think vampires have been written to death at this point. But make sure that you're not changing things so much by adding in just whatever that it doesn't even feel like a real vampire book anymore. I read a book that it doesn't seem like it should work, but it was outer space vampires, and I can't remember the title of it now, but it was fantastic because they kept the vampire lore, but they put the vampire in this vessel that they were traveling to deep space. So it worked because, you know, he couldn't die, so he could stay there forever. He didn't need to breathe. It was great. But I think you have to be kind of careful when you start doing that. I think it can become overwhelming for the reader and they have no idea what's going on.
Well, I mean, it's similar to what you were talking about as your approach, right? I mean, you're throwing a lot of stuff into the novel. Then comes the revision stage at which you have to go back through it and decide, well, this didn't work, or this needs to change, or this is in the wrong place, or whatever, right? And so maybe that's part of the answer to Jessica as well, which is that, you know, don't forget about revision. That's where it's all going to make sense. That's where you're going to make it make sense.
Right. And I mean, you do have to just be brutal with yourself and ask those questions I was saying earlier, like, what is this doing for the book? Like, why do I have this here? And if you don't have a good reason for it, you should pull it, because it's just not going to do anything for your book. It's going to just complicate it.
How are you able to develop that sense of like what's good for your book? How do you develop the sense to stop believing your own bullshit, and, you know, to put it, you know, bluntly? How do you develop that?
You read a lot, mm-hmm. and you ask yourself questions about the books you read, and you're brutal with other people's books first and figure out, like, okay, because you have more distance there. You can say, like, all right, this book didn't really work for me, and then say why. But I do it with movies. I do it with television shows. I mean, just ask yourself, like, did I like this? What did I like about it? And, you know, keep a book and write all that stuff down. Say, I really liked it because this character did this, or I didn't like it because I didn't believe in this villain, or, I mean, Voldemort, why was he bad? I don't know. You know, he's an orphan. I mean, that wasn't really explained. So, I mean, you ask those questions of yourself and write it all down. And then when you get to your own book, you have to ask those same questions. You know, why do I have this secondary character? You know, you know, do they have an actual conflict, or have I just created like a bad person and a good person that aren't really at odds with one another? And then break it down even further. Like, I've started doing this. One of my editors said you should keep a plot arc and a character arc for yep. all of your main characters. And where those diverge, you have to ask yourself, then how did they diverge and why? Because they shouldn't. I mean, as your plot goes, your character should also be moving there too. But if your plot's this way and your character's still going along a flat line, you need to ask yourself some questions there.
Yep. And that's actually how we try to teach character arcs and plots in the MFA, kind of parallel tracks. Developing that ability to look at your work with a cold and critical eye is so important. And yet another struggle is imposter syndrome and the inner critic, right? Who right from the start is telling you, well, you suck. You can't possibly write this. How dare you have ambitions to be a successful writer? And yet it's almost as though to become a successful writer, you have to sort of empower that inner critic a little bit. So how do you balance that? How do you keep the inner critic from like being a despot and completely ruining your, you know, your ability to create?
I think, part of it is that a critic is not telling you yourself you suck, right? I mean, that's just, that's just a bully. So you don't need a bully in your life, but you do need somebody to say, you know what, maybe you're not presenting this in the correct way. So if somebody comes to you and says, you look ugly, well, that's not very helpful. But if they say, you're not wearing clothes that are very flattering on you, maybe you should try this, this, and this. And so do that mm-hmm. with yourself. You know, don't say like, oh, you suck. You can never be a good writer. You'll never be successful. That's not helpful. But you can say like, you know, I'm not really good at writing dialogue. And this dialogue seems really clunky. I'm reading it aloud. It doesn't even sound like two people are talking. Like, how can I make myself learn to write better dialogue? I mean, go watch television shows that have really good dialogue and just kind of study that. Read books that you really have liked the dialogue sections, and then try to emulate that with your own writing. I think it's really that, you know, you need to make sure that inner critic, that person that's telling you that you're an imposter, isn't just very general, because I think that's what mm-hmm. happens to me, at least. It's like, oh, you're a hack. Sure, you've published 7 novels, but you'll never publish an 8th one. Like, that's not helpful. So I just kind of shut that one down and say, okay, well, it might be true that I haven't written in a while, but that doesn't mean I can't write today. And that doesn't mean what I'm writing today isn't going to be good. So I think you kind of have to just tell yourself, like, I'm just going to write this scene. I'm just going to write this character. And then I do not look at my work right away. I know everybody in this program seems to. I don't know how they do it, but they're like, oh, I'm reviewing my work 2 days after I wrote it, which is amazing. I can't do that. I have to put it away. But then by the time I come back at it with fresh eyes, that's really helpful, because it doesn't feel like my work anymore. And so the criticism coming from my brain is not, I suck. It's like, oh, this could be different.
Right. Let me go back into the chat and pull a question out of there. How do you come up with your characters in a way that makes them natural? Do you start out with their core hopes and fears, or do you figure out who they are as you write and then edit it later to be more cohesive?
I usually figure it out as they write, or as I write. I usually have, when I start with the main character, I usually have an idea of something strange that somebody's doing. It might be, well, in my latest novel, she's leaving her father in Maine. You don't know why. He's sending her off to New York City to live with her grandmother. So it might be something like that. And then you have to figure out, like, why is this person being sent off to New York City to live with her grandmother? So that becomes the character. Or it might be somebody whose mother is in a Renaissance fair, and then you have to kind of figure that out. Or somebody leaving to join the circus. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I start, is just kind of an odd situation where I put somebody in, and then I have to figure out who they are and why they're in that situation. I know some people don't do that. They like character generators, and they kind of move from there. And that is a good place to start.
Yeah, I like your approach, because it's kind of like solving a mystery.
Yeah.
Here's another question from the chat. How do you approach writing diverse characters?
I think you have to be, I was actually just listening to something on the way over here. There's an actor who he's a Black actor, and he was asked to play, like, all these characters were like thuggish, and they were criminals, or they were in gangs, or they were on drugs and all this other stuff. And he just finally said, I'm done with this. And I think that is a big problem, in that I think we have this idea that, like, this kind of person is going to be in this, they're going to be involved in this. So I think that's a big thing that we need to be careful about. Obviously just stereotypes in general, yeah. But like my friend who's a Black man living in Texas, he doesn't like football, you know, and that's okay. And I don't think we should assume, like my agent did, that he would know anything about football at all. I would say just kind of mix it up, but don't make it so crazy that it's obvious that you've made it that way. Mm-hmm. Like, don't try to write, oh, I'm going to write a Black man who likes ballet just because I want it to be different than football. Like, if he likes ballet, that's great, but that has to be part of your character's makeup.
Right. And then what about, you know, there are a lot of talk today around the idea of, like, you know, white writers kind of appropriating the experience of other races, other cultures, other kind of, like, you know, more marginalized voices. How do you, as a writer, deal with that without shutting down your, I don't know, whatever part of you that says, I do need to have, you know, X character here who needs to do Y, right? Why do you need that? Well, because that's what I'm imagining. And so how do you navigate that, which seems like a bit of a minefield these days?
It is a minefield. I mean, I my latest novel that I've been working on, I sent to an agent, and it was going to be, it's set in the future. It was going to be a predominantly Asian culture. And she said, absolutely not. You can't do that. You're going to have to set it back in the United States with white people. It was like, oh, okay. So I think that it is a minefield. I think if you are a white writer and you're attempting to write about other cultures, you have to be very sensitive and very careful. And you need to be aware too that your book may not get picked up, because there will be people that are going to say, like, that's not your story to tell.
Right.
They might be right. Absolutely. And I think that if you're doing sci-fi or maybe fantasy, you have a little more latitude there. I think that you can write different stories in an alternate universe rather than in our own. You have a little more room. No, I know. And absolutely. But I guess the same thing when it comes to writing about even your own experience and your own culture, I think there can be a lot of people that would assume things. When I was in my MFA program, I wrote a story about people in drill team, and I got savaged by the person leading the workshop because she thought I was writing an autobiographical story. And I was like, I wasn't in drill team. Like, I wasn't a cheerleader. And not that there's anything wrong with being a cheerleader, but that wasn't my story. And she just assumed it was because, uh-huh, I guess, of what I looked like. And so I think there's some of that too. It's like, I think there can be prejudice against you because of who you are or where you're from or how old you are or anything. So I don't know. I think that's just, like you said, it's a minefield. I think you just have to go in eyes wide open and do the best you can and expect to get some pushback, but then take that as good critique and try to be more sensitive about the areas that you're writing.
Yeah. And that's good advice, period, for any writing, I think. That brings us to, Jessica has another question. Do you have time for one more question? Yeah. Jessica says, that is very confusing, referring to the conversation that we were just having. I am a total mutt, she says. My mom is a feisty redhead, and my dad is an educated Black and Native Marine. Now this minefield states I can't write anything. How would you respond to that?
No, I don't think that's true at all. I don't think you can't write anything. I think that you may have to make your case to to an agent or publisher if you were to write about something that does not physically traditionally represent you? And I'm not sure exactly how to present that. For instance, I'm co-authoring with my friend who's a Black man, and I know the story that we're writing set in inner city Houston about predominantly Black teenagers. I can't pitch that book. I mean, I would not be able to, but he can. And so I already know right away, like, that's pretty much going to be his book. I mean, I'm not going to be the person going on tour with that book. And I think that, so if you're writing about something, you just have to keep that in mind. Like, you may have to make a case to your publisher or your agent that, yes, I know what I'm talking about. This is something that's part of my life, part of my culture. I did grow up in the Bayou of Louisiana, or I did grow up in West Texas, or I have lived on the coast of Maine. And so I do have the authority to write about lots of kids dying of fentanyl. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that you can make that position, but it should be authentic.
Yeah, that's what it comes down to, authenticity. Once you can fake that, you got it made. As I can't remember who said that, but somebody did. That's going to be it for tonight. We were at our stopping point. So Heather, I want to thank you so much for joining us. This was really a fun and informative night. I think we covered a lot of great stuff. I want to thank our audience for coming and asking such great questions. And we will see you next time, which is the second Monday of every month. I don't know offhand what that is in February, but our guest is going to be Instructor Jason Morgan. So really looking forward to that. And I wish everyone good night